Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Good morning. This is Tracy Halesvass with Right on Four Corners on KSJE, the information and cultural beacon of the Four Corners in Farmington, New Mexico. Today I'm talking with Portia Sykes about her novel Eat the Moon, a climatic love story to save the world. Good morning, Portia.
Good morning, Tracy.
Thanks for coming into the studio today.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. And thanks for writing this book. I think it's a really important, though set in fiction, book.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you say that, Eat the Moon, a climatic love story to save the world. I know that you talk about at the beginning of it how, or at the introduction, how you really wanted to get a voice to some of the concerns you had.
Yes. And in today's day and age, there's a lot of dystopia
Yes.
being created. I have a literature background and a film and television background before I was Dr. Sykes. When I started to really look out in the world, there's a lot of darkness being created. And while I'm more than capable of thinking of really horrific situations, I don't need to put those ideas in the brainstems of other fellow humans. So I wanted to kind of steer the world a little better in a direction that I think is more beneficial and influence the world in whatever way I could that's just a healthier way.
Right, right. Well, before we proceed, why don't you give us the listeners a little synopsis?
Well, it is a love story in essence, heart and soul. It is a love story. It's a story of first love and love at first sight, but it's also a love of nature and the planet and each other and our ancestors and the children to come. So in essence, that's what it is. The plot line covers two different people, young people, who on the surface may appear kind of different. Colton James Miller is a young Farmington man who works with his family, working in repair and service industry for oil and gas. And he has a great life. He's a wonderful person. But he's got these fears and concerns and worries that are kind of in the background that he kind of struggles with. And Saffron LeMay, is a character who is fictionally set in an intentional commune at Navajo Dam. And she's in some ways a polar opposite. She almost knows too much about the state of the world today. And so she wrestles with her own fears and tries to see the world as positively as she can, but it's a struggle. And the two of them are kind of thrown together in a fateful supercell storm, very similar to the one we had here about 6 years ago. I kind of recreated that for the book. And as they, you kind of unite and they see a lot more of what they have in common. And over a period of about a week and a half, life continues to throw them curveballs and throw them together. There's average problems of breakups and relationships, but there's bigger threats and threat of violence and instability starting to increase in the world and facing the knowledge that the climate is destabilizing. How do you go forward with hope, with a sense of purpose? So that's the book in its essence.
You know, I really liked the two protagonists. Now, Colton was your typical Farmington guy. I guess I shouldn't say that, but he really is, with the belt buckle and the cowboy hat and everything, working on the oil field. But Saffron, what do you call her, a hippie punk?
A hippie punk.
Yes, and she is a wonderful person. Yeah, you really captured the two characters and made them very real. And I loved Sweetwater, the intentional community wherein Saffron lived. It's a wonderful place.
Thank you.
Yes.
While I was researching, I looked a lot into intentional communities, and a lot of their benefits are going to be some of the things that they are involved are very good and practical for going forward with the climate. But I also recognize we are not all going to pick up and move into intentional communities. The idea of caring for our neighbors and fixing where we're planted is very important. But the lessons from having those kind of communities, I think, is going to be relevant going forward for a lot of different type of people.
Right.
Yeah.
And you say that this is in the very near future.
Correct. The book when we're going to hit 450 carbon parts per million in the atmosphere. I didn't check it today, but we are over 400. One of the characters says, from the time of my birth until now, it's gone over 100 points, and it totally ticked her off. Well, that's me. I'm 50 mm-hmm. years old, and it was 327 in 1970, and we're about, I think, 413 is the last I saw.
Wow.
So it's got climate science facts.
Mm-hmm.
And I read Denier. I read everything. I have studied this problem from all different aspects, and it just occurred to me that, well, boy, am I just sitting around going, gee, I hope the fellas fix it. And it just seemed like, well, I have way more power. And all of us have way more power than we really give ourselves credit for. So what are we going to do with this life that's been given us and this time that we have so that we can live in a life that's worthy of our souls?
And you have done that in the story. You've taken your writing to tell, you know, as an alarm, as a laying down the facts in a really readable way. And Saffron herself is a singer, and they talk about her singing to get the word across about the climate problems. And I really liked that. I went, oh, that's a correlation there.
Well, I kind of thought it'd be fun if the real world and the fiction kind of played
right
together.
Right.
And, you know, to influence, I've always wanted to write. My mother used to always tell me I would be a writer, and I've studied literature and I've had classes, but it was always something that I've kicked down the road. And there was a time when I really started to do a lot more research into the climate, because it occurred to me I didn't know enough, and that seemed kind of stupid for me to be so smart and unknowledgeable. When I realized I really wanted to do something about it, the idea for this book, I can't even explain it. It just came into me on a molecular level. I felt called.
I was going to ask you about its conception. How long did it take you to write this?
3.5 years.
Not bad.
It was done last. It was done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, put my last prayer into it and closed it up, and the virus hit.
That affected everything.
And I spent the last year really reflecting, kind of recovering from my own COVID long hauler type symptoms, and really wondering if this was exactly what I wanted to put out. Was the world ready to kind of talk about this? And I've had a lot of reflection to get in a state of mind where I can talk about these subjects and not be angry or unreasonable. I want to be effective. So it's been done and ready for a while, but it took me a little time to get to a place where I was ready to share it.
Now, writing it, did you know the story and start from the beginning and write to the end of it?
I conceived of almost all of it really fast. It unfolded quickly. It came out of me like I was just channeling it for some, you know, higher power and muse. And it was wonderful. Every time I needed guidance, something would come to me. I was shown, you know, just the universe. God gave me everything I needed. And it unfolded pretty rapidly. But it was interesting, in this, you know, the last 4 years have been intense for us as a country. You know, there's a scene in there with you know, threats at a riot, even at a farmer's market. And I knew early on I was going to write that. And I came up to the scene and we had the shooting at Aztec High School.
Amazing.
I couldn't write that scene for a while.
Yeah.
I had to move on. And so, you know, there's been interesting watching the real world kind of, unravel in mm-hmm. some ways, and have my book in some mimic in some ways some of the instability in the real world. But life and fiction, it's always right. been interlinked in those so many ways.
So when did the characters come to you?
Quickly.
So did you start off with a story and then the characters made themselves real, or did you get your characters first?
It all unfolded pretty simultaneously. Mm-hmm. I knew I wanted no bad guys because, yes, we're different, but I think it's wonderful. There's a reason why we're all so different, and we all have so many different gifts. So I didn't want anyone in particular to be demonized,
right?
You know, so this is a book with conservatives and liberals who like each other. But yes, the character development, I worked it pretty quickly. I knew what I wanted to have
because they're very real characters.
Thank
like
you.
I said, yes, I really liked them both of them and everybody else. Zia and Jack, the parents of Saffron, are great characters also. And
Cricket and Asa.
Right. They're very, I know people like that all over the place, mm-hmm. especially in Farmington. So it really rang true to the area and to people that I've met and known. I don't want to give anything away, but I know there's another character who is really passionate also about climate change, but wants to handle it in a little bit different way.
There's a lot of angry people in our world.
Yes.
And anger, I don't ever want to invalidate anger.
Right.
I have my own anger, but it's not how you solve problems. You know, parents know you can be angry, but you have to rise above and go forward. And so, yes, one of the characters, you know, he's just got an overinflated sense of justice and he's ready to take action.
Right.
But it's more of a destructive action.
Right. But his anger is a righteous anger. I mean, he has a right to be. I mean, his anger is justified, I guess I should
say. Many people feel like our angers are justified.
And Saffron doesn't think he's handling it right.
That's correct. Yeah.
So that was good to show that side of it, too.
Good.
It would be a good time now for you to read a little from Eat the Moon.
I'm going to start with chapter one.
Great.
Eye of the Storm.
Good.
Colton took his hands off the wheel and killed the boat's engine. He didn't have to look behind him to know the storm would hit any moment. He could feel it coming, like a remnant from a bad dream. His ears rang with its heart-stopping roar, the hair on his arms raised, skin tingling, a metallic taste in his molars. Reluctantly, he turned to watch the wall of advancing rain battering Navajo Lake, slapping and pounding the surface as if it were miraculously solid enough to walk upon. With little time to act, he raced to the edge of the boat, searching the starboard side for the stranded woman in the water. Peering down, he found her, wide-eyed and pale-faced, fighting wildly to right an overturned kayak, which was still buoyed by trapped air. Seeing him, her grim look of raw desperation was replaced by a bright light, as if the sun shone inside of her. For a brief moment, Colton thought he'd seen the face of an angel. In the east, lightning exploded, crackling with foreboding energy. The mist thickened into a fog, obscuring his vision before changing into a merciless pelting like a faucet turned on high. Reflexively, he gasped as he was instantly chilled and soaked to the bone by the unexpected and unwelcome baptism. Struggling to see, he reached down into the dark and difficult waves, his fingers momentarily brushing against hers. The yellow kayak lost its battle and transformed into a yellow submarine, plummeting into the depths of the lake. Suddenly, her strong arm grasped his own, and under the torrential downpour, he helped her climb onto the deck. Above, thunder cracked like a god with an urgent message. The storm surged ahead, its clouds swirling in an arc, high in the sky, up and over them in a downdraft, its forceful tailwind driving the rain parallel to the lake. To Colton, it felt like a perverse tidal wave descending from above as a high-pressured fire hose assaulted him simultaneously. With no other option for escape, they hid under the small roof of the center console, huddling together for shelter, but the wind and rain came at them from all directions, seeming to defy the law of gravity. Heads down and bodies entwined, they curled on the floor as the boat lurched and swayed with a stomach-churning recklessness. Colton felt the young woman shaking in his arms, then realized the sensation was coming from himself. His breathing was hitched, ragged with adrenaline as unwanted memories of a past hurricane hijacked his mind. The raging wind and turbulent water were overwhelmingly familiar. "Please, God," he thought and prayed, "I don't want to die." Fighting his escalating panic, he looked up with half-closed eyes through the gloom to gauge their position. His boat had been driven like a child's toy towards the steep-walled portion of the Pine River Pass. Sandstone cliffs enveloped them on both sides as they swiftly drifted towards the rain-slicked rocks. "I have to stop the boat!" he yelled over the tumultuous noise. The young woman released her arms, which had been clutching him tightly around his waist. The two untangled clumsily and stood up together to face the next challenge. "Oh, shoot," she said, cursing as the cliff face sped towards them. Clambering to the front of the craft, she searched the bench seats for padding and quickly attached them to the sides of the boat as a cushion against the shock of impact. Colton turned towards the steering console. He tried starting the engine, but it remained stalled. Irrevocably, the rocks drew closer. Bending down, he grabbed a rope, making sure the knot was secure, then wrestled the anchor overboard, the line unfurling rapidly at his feet. The boat snapped to a halt, jarring both passengers a mere 4 feet away from the canyon wall. Time stretched and held its breath, the way time sometimes does. 3 minutes passed in slow motion before the apocalyptic rain dialed down to a typical summer thunderstorm, still intense but no longer of biblical proportions. "That was close," the young woman said, looking up at the sky. Her voice was direct, like she was making a calculated observation, but there was a slightly haunted look in her blue eyes as she contemplated the receding storm. Her lips were a cherry red, and her hair was an amber glow of wet tendrils down her shoulders. She was petite and curvy. What cleavage dared to show from the top of her dark green t-shirt was wet with rain and sun-kissed with light freckles. On her shirt was a picture of the planet Earth with the words, "Save me." How ironic, he thought. He watched her take a deep breath and stretch her body, raising her arms above her head, her feet up on tiptoe. Holding the pose, she balanced upon the waves and gazed appreciatively around her as if the most beautiful view she'd ever seen. When her eyes finally settled on his, her smile broadened. Colton's heart clichéd and skipped a beat. "Hi," she said, reaching for his hand. "I'm Saffron." And thus they meet. So that they complement each other. And I think that's what we need to know about the real world. This is going to be a trilogy. Swallow the Sun is not going to take tier. And, you know, I've spent 30 years living in small towns, rural towns, but I also have 20 years living in the metropolis of Chicago and the suburbs. And, you know, what we're going to do to fix these problems is going to vary.
Right.
And what we do in a small town is going to look different from what needs to happen in a bigger city. So book two is going to be urban. And a little bit more complicated in a lot of ways.
Are we going to see Saffron and Colton?
Number three.
Good.
Book three. They're all going to come together in book three.
Good.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm a problem solver by nature.
Right.
And that's what I wanted to kind of put into people's heads, that there's so much that is in our power. I don't like to feel powerless.
Right.
My characters don't like to feel powerless.
Right.
And so I wanted to give people that idea that there's so much that we do have choices over and power over, and they don't have to be destructive.
So is that in process now?
Yes.
Writing it? Good.
Yes. I've had notes all ready to go. I've been collecting information and ideas the entire time, and now that this one's published, I'm starting to develop book two even more. I also kind of want to write more of a health-related nonfiction book.
Oh, good.
So we're going to see how that comes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm waiting for maybe I can have some kind of lovely benefactor.
It could happen.
I have these secret fantasies of,
why not?
You know, but yes. I can also wake up at 4 a.m. and do my writing,
right?
And do my miracle morning and make the book happen in the hours that are presented to me, because time is our asset. This took priority.
Oh, okay, great.
I love helping people. Mm-hmm. I love strengthening people and reducing their pain. I've spent a lot of time for the last couple of years fixing myself, mm-hmm. to make myself stronger. And some of the ideas, you know, the idea, if we were to all start to improve physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, even sexually, you know, the Me Too movement happened during the writing of this book.
Right.
If we all kind of take those jobs on, that this is the time, if you were waiting for some future tomorrow, it's now.
It's now.
Well, doing that not only improves us, it's like pebbles in a pond. It fixes families. It fixes communities. It fixes the soil. So, and all the different things that, how we are interconnected. So
yes.
I kind of want to put that idea into people. Like, I know people want to be better.
I think that's a huge thing. Even Colton's family, they didn't like some of the ideas that were new to him, yet they weren't content with the way they were.
We have, life is hard.
Yeah, it is.
I have young children, and I want them to see the beauty and the hopefulness in this world, because it's everywhere. But at the same time, you know, we're all responsible for our own well-being in many ways. So
how did your healing practice inform your writing?
Well, one of the reasons I had never created anything in the past, you know, I went to film school. I helped other people make their movies. I wrote, you know, I read other people's books and wrote about them, but I didn't write my own. And I was always overwhelmed that there was too much I wanted to say. How do you pick just one thing to say?
Right.
And I wrote this book thinking, well, if I never write another, if I'm prevented in some form or fashion, and this is the only book I ever get to say or to create, I'm going to let it say everything. So it is written as a mother and as a healer, and from many different aspects. I poured as much ideas into it as I possibly could. So if anybody's reading and you don't see something that you recognize, you're like, oh, I don't know anything about that. That's a very good clue that you should go jump down a rabbit hole and go start learning more, because it's pretty intentionally written to point people in the right direction.
Yes, it should, I think, elicit concern and a desire in people to go seek more information.
Good.
And I think you've led, in the back of the book, you've given some ideas on where to go and what to read. And you also have a website, which is a nice website, by the way, PortiaDSykes.com, PortiaD as in dog, mm-hmm. Sykes with a Y, SYKES.com.
Yes.
And on that site, you have a blog going on.
We're starting that. It's interesting. I wrote this book so I could have a voice, and it's been challenging.
Yes.
Developing that voice. And I've also kind of gotten quieter over the last couple of years, because listening is to each other.
Right.
Is something that's so valuable. And I knew that once I started talking, I might not stop. So I've had a lot of quiet time for introflection, you know. And as far as there's so much out there. I'm seeing it more and more today than when I began the book.
Mm-hmm.
More people are speaking out and creating, and I wanted to be a part of that. I can read very intense scientific books,
yes,
and medical books. I have that training. I have that
right
background. But the majority of people are not going to take in some of the, more scientific,
right,
details. But at the same time, I feel like you should be pushed to do it.
I think so
too.
The book is encased in facts and data and really solid information given through the characters. And this way, I mean, I learned a lot.
Good.
It's not an area where I was unfamiliar with, and it is a concern of mine, but the way that you have put the information across between these two lovers and all the other people has been really, I think it'll really be a good way for other people to get it.
I hope so. When in the research, I found multiple sources. Even Newsweek had an article about climate scientists are freaking out.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you see them interviewed. They look haunted. And what I read in multiple sources is that they feel like they failed to get the information into the mainstream culture. And as when the book idea came into me, I was like, well, why have I been given the life I've been given? Why have I met all the people I've met? Why do I have this experience with rural and urban, rich, poor? Why have I met all these famous people in my life? What am I going to do with this? And how can I take this information and get it in a way that the masses,
right,
you know,
right,
can, and again, put it in a slant that's not dystopia.
It's not dystopia. It's not even threatening. And I think a lot of people are like Colton's family, who probably know about the climate problems, but they choose to ignore it because what changes they would have to make.
You know, being a parent, sometimes you have to do things and say things that you wish you didn't have to. There was one article, one book I read, Climageddon, mm-hmm, it was called, and it's really well laid out. And there was a point in the book where he says, once you understand this information, there's six ways to respond. You can deny it's happening because you're overwhelmed, because you disagree with the science, or you profit from disagreeing, you know, denying. But you can accept it's happening and still feel overwhelmed and do nothing. You can accept and only focus on your own family's survival. You know, I've done a lot of prepping and survivalists. I've got all that information, you know, and some of that's in this book. But he said, you can realize it's happening and do everything in your power to make a difference. And then the idea of the book came into me.
Great.
It was that realization, like, you know, I'm not going to just help my own family. What more can I do? And so that idea I'd like to instill in everybody, because it's not my job to fix it. It's not yours. It's ours.
It's ours.
Ours.
Right, collectively.
Correct.
And use the gifts that we have been given to do what we can, as you have done with so many things and also your writing.
And then now there's going forward into the real world.
Right.
This book I've been mailing out to all these different famous people, and
I'm sending
out to climatologists, and I'm sending it to politicians, and sending it to churches, and I'm throwing darts at a dartboard, and something's going to stick, and the universe gets to decide how big of a movement, and some people will get influenced and or inspired. And it might inspire somebody else to create another way of presenting the information,
right,
that another person might respond better to than,
exactly,
the way I portrayed it. You know, when you're writing, especially nowadays, it's all about metadata.
Right. It is.
And my husband used to talk to me. He's like, well, who are you writing the book for? Who's your audience? And I'm like, everybody.
The whole world.
Where's the metadata for everybody?
Right.
And it's kind of lofty, but I think being the age I am, I'm halfway. I'm in the middle.
There you go.
The people who raised me are 100 years old and 90 and 70. And,
right.
And yet I've also experienced life through the eyes of 40-year-olds, 30-year-olds, children. I see so much value in everybody's perspective. I'm very heartened to see what's going to happen with the older generations and the younger generations, and hopefully we can really come together on this issue.
And on your website, you have some contact information, so
yes,
if somebody wants to reach you,
they can reach me through Portia D. Sykes at Outlook.
Okay.
That's my email address.
And where can the book be found?
It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's in all the local bookstores here. I have it up in Durango. It's in Albuquerque, Barnes & Noble, and we're going to keep on getting into different stores, but it's available for all the libraries, and everybody who wants to order it, you should be able to find it online. great ebook version and paperback. Well, thank you so much for having me, Tracy.
Well, thank you, Portia, and thank you for writing this. And that was Dr. Portia Sykes talking about her very important book, Eat the Moon, A Climatic Love Story to Save the World. This is Tracy Hales Vass with Right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM in Farmington, New Mexico.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.